Adam in Zuccotti Park, Lower Manhattan. This time, the fieldwork comes to him. The forces he has been studying his entire professional life are loose again and partying in the heart of the financial district, a few blocks south of where he works and lives. The park is buzzing. The squared circles of honey locusts already tint yellow, and all underneath them, sleeping bags and tents make camp between the skyscrapers. Hundreds slept here last night, as they have for days. They fall asleep to songs of protest and wake to the free hot meal served by five-star chefs donating their efforts to the cause. Only Adam isn't sure what the cause is. The cause is a work in progress. Justice for the 99%. The jailing of financial traitors and thieves. An eruption of fairness and decency on all continents. The overthrow of capitalism. A happiness not born of rape and greed. The city prohibits all amplified sound, but the human megaphone is in full swing. One woman chants, and the people all around her pick up the words. Banks got bailed out. Banks got bailed out. We got sold out. We got sold out. Occupy. Occupy. Whose streets? Whose streets? Our streets. Our streets. Still the resolutely young, keeping true to the world-saving dreams of their youth. But among the ethnic vests and backpacks are men older than Adam. In breakout sessions around the square, women in their 60s pass along the institutional memory of insurgents. People in leotards pedal stationary bikes to generate electricity for the occupation's laptops. Barbers give away free haircuts, since the bankers seem unwilling to get theirs cropped. People in Guy Fawkes masks hand out leaflets. College kids stand in a ring and drum. Lawyers behind flimsy card tables donate legal advice. Someone has been hard at work defacing signs. No skateboarding, rollerblading, or bicycling allowed in the park. Otherwise, all good, bro. And what's a circus without a band? A whole battalion of guitars, one with the inscription, "This machine kills day traders," joins together in a chorus of high lonesome. For the police make it hard wherever I may go, 'cause I ain't got no home in this world anymore. Just beyond the square's far corner is the wound that won't heal. The hole in the canopy has long since filled in, but it still oozes. A decade has passed since the buildings fell. The math astounds Adam. His own son is only 5, but the attacks feel younger. A tree, a calorie pear that survived, half-burned and with roots snapped, has just returned in good health to ground zero. He squeezes through a channel in the milling crowd alongside the People's Library. He can't help grazing the shelves and bins. There's Milgram's Obedience to Authority, marked up with a million tiny marginal words. There's a collection of Tagore, lots of Thoreau, and even more copies of You versus Wall Street. Free circulation on the honor system. Smells like democracy to him. 6,000 books, and out of them all, one small volume floats up to the surface of its heap like a fossil coughed out of a peat bog. The Golden Guide to Insects. Bright yellow, the only real edition that classic ever had. In shock, Adam picks it up and opens to the title page, ready to see his own name gouged there in smudgy number 2 all caps balloons. But the name is someone else's, inked in Palmer Method cursive. Raymond B. The pages stink of mildew and the purity of child science. Adam flips through, recalling everything. The field notebooks and home natural history museum. The pond scum under the cheap child's microscope. Above all, the daubs of fingernail polish on the abdomens of ants. Somehow, He has managed to spend his entire life repeating that experiment. He lifts his eyes from the miniature page, weevils and caddisflies, to watch this happy, furious, anarchic swarm. For a few seconds he sees the system of ranks and duties, the waggle dances, the trails of pheromone that feel from inside the hive like pure physics, the pull of gravity. He wants to paint them all with a daub of polish and climb up 40 floors in the next-door high-rise for a better look. The look of a real field scientist. The look of a 10-year-old. He sticks the golden guide into his pants pocket and ducks back into the crowd. 10 steps down, seated on the edge of a granite slab bench, a ghost swings its face toward him and startles. "Occupy!" someone shouts into the human megaphone. And the word comes 100 times louder out the other end. "Occupy!" The ghost's surprise turns into a grin. Adam knows the guy like it's his brother back from the dead. The man he sees is balding in a baseball cap, where the one he remembers had a luxurious ponytail. He can't for the life of him say who the man is. Then he can, and he doesn't want to. It's too late for anything but to walk up and clasp the intruder by the forearm, laughing at the evidence, like luck is such a rascal and the strange old story will lurch forever on. Doug Fir.
Maple! Whoa! This can't be real!
They embrace like two old men already over the finish line.
Jesus! Man, life is long, huh?
Longer than anyone. The psychologist can't stop shaking his head. He doesn't want this. The corpse being pulled up out of the tumulus by brutal archaeologists is not him. But the run-in is funny, somehow. Chance. That comedian with the perfect timing. Are you here for... Adam waves toward the teeming crowd saving mankind from itself. Pavlicek,
the name is.
Pavlicek wrinkles up his eyebrows and scouts the square, like he's just seeing it this moment.
Ah, nah, man, not me. I'm just a spectator these days. Don't get out much. Haven't made a peep since, you know.
Adam takes the man, still gawky, still adolescent, by the bony elbow. Let's walk. They stroll down Broadway, past Citibank, Ameritrade, Fidelity. The years they need to catch up on are done in a New York minute. Professor of psychology at NYU, with wife who publishes self-help books, and 5-year-old son who wants to be a banker when he grows up. Longtime BLM employee, between jobs and residences, here in town to see his friend. The end. But they keep walking, under the spire of Trinity Church, passing near the ghost of the buttonwood tree, that sycamore where businessmen once met to trade stock, now the site of Free Enterprise's main engine room. And they keep talking, a slow circle around the past, whose circumference Adam won't be able to retrace even an hour later. Douglas keeps touching the brim of the baseball cap, like he's tipping it to passers-by. Adam asks, "Are you in touch with anyone?"
"In touch?"
"With the others." Douglas fiddles with the cap.
"No. You?"
"I... no. Mulberry? No idea. But Watchman? This sounds crazy. It's like he's following me around." Douglas stops on the sidewalk in a sea of businessmen.
"What does that mean?"
"I'm probably nuts. But I travel a lot for the job, lectures and conferences all over the country. And in at least 3 cities, I've seen street art that looks just like those drawings he used to make."
"The tree people?"
"Yeah,
You remember how weird...
Douglas nods, fingering the brim. A group of tourists ring the sidewalk in front of them around a wild animal. Its huge, muscular, charging nostrils flared, with long, wicked horns ready to gore the throng, ringing it and taking selfies. 7,000 pounds of bronze gorilla art, trucked in by its maker in the dead of night and left on the stoop of the stock exchange as a gift to the public. When the city tried to haul it away, people objected. The Trojan bull. A few short weeks ago, a ballerina riding the beast bareback in mid-pirouette became the stunning poster child of the latest Stop the Humans movement. What is our one demand? Hashtag Occupy Wall Street. Bring tent. People take turns buddying up for a picture with the charging animal. Douglas doesn't seem to get the irony. His eyes are everywhere except where the crowd is looking. Something fights out of him.
So, he rubs his neck, you have a pretty good life now.
Crazy lucky, though I work long hours. The research is a pleasure.
What exactly do you research?
Adam has performed the soundbite thousands of times for everyone from anthology editors to strangers on airplanes. But this man, he owes this man a little more. I was working on the topic already when we met, when the five of us... The focus has changed over the years, but it's the same basic problem. What keeps us from seeing the obvious? Douglas puts his hand to the brass bull's horn.
And? What does?
Mostly other people.
You know...
Douglas looks up Broadway to see what so enrages the bull.
I may have hit upon that idea independently.
Adam laughs so loud the tourists turn to look. He remembers why he loved the man once, why he trusted him with his life. There's a more interesting part of the question.
How some people manage to see?
Exactly. With a gesture, an Asian tourist asks the two men to step away from the statue for the length of a quick photo. Adam nudges Douglas, and they walk some more down into the teardrop of Bowling Green Park.
I've thought a lot, Douglas says, about what happened.
Me too. Right away, Adam wants to retract the lie.
What were we hoping to accomplish? What did we think we were doing?
They stand under the circle of camouflaged platanus, that most resigned of eastern trees, on the spot where the island was sold by people who listened to trees to people who cleared them. They gaze together at the geyser fountain. Adam says, "We set buildings on fire."
We did.
We believed that humans were committing mass murder.
Yes.
No one else could see what was happening. Nothing was going to stop unless people like us forced the issue. The beak of Douglas's ball cap swings back and forth.
We weren't wrong, you know. Look around. Anyone paying attention knows the party's over. Gaia's taking her revenge.
Gaia? Adam smiles, but pained.
Life. The planet. We're already paying. But even now, a guy is still a lunatic for saying as much.
Adam assesses the man. So you'd do it all again, what we did? The questions of rogue philosophers play in Adam's head, the taboo ones. How many trees equal one person? Can an impending catastrophe justify small, pointed violence?
Do it again? I don't know. I don't know what that means.
Burn buildings.
I ask myself at nights whether anything we did, anything we could have done, would ever make up for that woman's death.
And then, it's like the day is night, the city a spruce pine woods, the park all on fire around them, and that fine, strange, pale woman is lying on the ground begging for water.
We accomplished nothing, Adam says. Not one thing.
They turn to leave the park, a place too crowded for this conversation. At the gate in the low iron fence, only then do they realize there's no place safer.
She would have done it all again.
Douglas points at Adam's chest.
You loved her.
We all loved her. Yes.
You were in love with her. Same as Watchman. Same as Mimi.
It was a long time ago.
You would have bombed the Pentagon for her.
Adam smiles, soft and pale. She did have a power.
She said the trees were talking to her, that she could hear them.
A shrug, a furtive watch check. He needs to get back uptown to prep a lecture. Too much history sickens Adam. So he was younger once, angrier. Another species, just a failed experiment. The only thing that needs negotiation is now. Douglas won't leave him be.
Do you think anything was really talking to her? Or was she just...
The world had 6 trillion trees when people showed up. Half remain. Half again more will disappear in 100 years. And whatever enough people say that all these vanishing trees are saying is what, in fact, they say. But the question interests Adam. What did the dead Joan of Arc hear? Insight or delusion? Next week, he'll tell his undergrads about Durkheim, Foucault, crypto-normativity. How reason is just another weapon of control. How the invention of the reasonable, the acceptable, the sane, even the human, is greener and more recent than humans suspect. Adam casts a look behind them, down the concrete canyon of Beaver Street. Beavers, the creatures whose pelts built this city, the original Manhattan Exchange. He hears himself answer, "Trees used to talk to people all the time. Sane people used to hear them." The only question is whether they'll talk again before the end.
That night, Douglas lifts his face to the skyscraper wall, when we sent you for help, why did you come back?
Anger surges through Adam, as if the two of them will fight again. It was too late. Finding help would have taken hours. She was dead already. If I'd gone to the police, she'd still be dead, and we'd all be locked up.
You didn't know that, man. You don't know that now.
Rage, the radical tip of a grief that time will never root out. They pass a small European redbud, 20 feet tall. Its spine arches, and its limbs curve like those of the ballerina bull dancer. The profusion of purple-pink edible buds growing right out of the trunk and twigs is still a winter away. Now seed pods dangle from the branches like so many hanged men. They say Judas hanged himself from a cyrsus. It's a new enough myth, as tree myths go. Judas trees grow in corners hidden throughout Lower Manhattan. This one will be gone before it blooms twice more. The men stop at Battery Place, where their paths split, down the street and across the water, Liberty. There's a certain squirrel, a ghost animal, the subject of endless eulogies, who runs forever through the canopies of a giant ghost forest from here to the Mississippi without ever touching paws to the ground. It's all island hopping now, through scattered fragments of second growth, subtended by highways littered with roadkill. But the men stop to look, as if the endless forest still starts there, in front of them. They turn to one another and hug goodbye, like bears testing their strength against each other, like they'll never see each other again in this life, like even then it would be too soon. The trees refuse to say a thing. Nile sits in Stanford's inner quad, the intergalactic botanical garden, waiting for an explanation. The lifelong calling has gone wrong. He's lost the trail they set him on. What now? But the trees snub him. The bulging water sack of the bottle tree, the spiked armor of the silk floss, not even a rustle of leaves. It's as if his soulmate, in the only galaxy that ever offered him one, has plunged from bliss to panic at the first ripple and cut him dead. He's ruining tourists' photographs. No one wants a shot of a nice fake Spanish Romanesque cloister with a crippled freak in the foreground. He spins to go, as furious as any jilted lover. But go where? Even returning to his apartment above the Semper Virens headquarters is a humiliation. He'd call his mother, but it's the middle of the night in Banswara, where she now spends most of her year getting ready to die. She knows now, 10 years too late, that there will never be any Rupal for him, that science will never reactivate his legs, and that the best way to love her son is to release him to his isolation. She comes back now only whenever he's hospitalized, when the doctors must debride his epic bed sores or cut away parts of his necrotic feet and ass. Boarding a plane has become an exercise in pain. He won't tell her the next time he goes in. He rolls down into the oval toward the grandiose line of palms. The sky is too clear, the day too hot, and all the trunks have turned to synchronized sundials. He finds a shady spot, an increasingly popular sport worldwide. Then he sits still, trying to be only where he is, here, home. No good. In a minute he's agitated, checking his phone for messages not yet posted to him. Where can people live? His elves must be right, only in symbols, in simulation. As he puts the device back in its wheelchair pouch, it buzzes like a fistful of cicadas. It's a message from his personal AI. The thing is alive, cagey, teasing him with the clickbait game of humanity. Since childhood, even before his fall, he has dreamed of such a robot pet. This one is better than anything the prophets of his childhood sci-fi predicted. Faster, sleeker, and suppler. It goes out at all hours and scours humankind's entire activity, then reports back to him. It's obedient and untiring. And like the only creatures that he trusts these days, it has no legs. Legs, Nile suspects, may be where evolution went berserk. He and his people made the pet, and now it's busy making him. He told it to watch for any news of his new obsession, tree communication, forest intelligence, fungal networks, Patricia Westerford, The Secret Forest. The book is shot through with uncanny echoes of what he heard whispered decades ago by alien life forms that now won't give him the time of day. It has cost him his role as the creative head of his company. It wants more from him, more payment, more salvage. But what? He opens the message from the bot. It contains a link and a title. Words of Air and Light. The recommendation strength is as high as his pet gives. Even in his spot of shade, Nile can't read the screen. He rolls to the van, parked not far away. Back inside his emptied-out interstellar ship, He clicks on the link and watches in confusion. Shadows and sun burst forth. 100 years of chestnut erupt in 20 seconds, like a scene in a hand-cranked kinetoscope. It's over before Nile makes it out. He starts the clip again. The tree fountains up once more into a crown. The upward wavering twigs reach for the light, for things hidden in plain sight. Branches fork and thicken in the air. At this speed, he sees the tree's central aim, the math behind the phloem and xylem, the intermeshed and seething geometries, and that thin layer of living cambium swelling outward. Code, wildly branching code pruned back by failure, builds up this great spiraling column from out of instructions that Vishnu managed to cram into something smaller than a boy's fingernail. When the tree is done with its century of unfolding, old chestnut words of extinct transcendentalism scroll upward, line by line, on a sea of black. The gardener sees only the gardener's garden. The eyes were not made for such groveling uses as they are now put to and worn out by, but to behold beauty now invisible. May we not see God? And when Nile looks up from the tiny screen, that's exactly what he sees. Just across campus from his van, beyond the eucalyptus groves, invitations go out. They disperse in clumps like airborne pollen. One lands on Patricia Westerford, in a cabin in an institute in the Great Smoky Mountains. She's searching out prime strains of the dozens of hardwoods that may fall in a few years to the ash borer and long-horned beetles. These days, such invitations reach her by the dozens, and she mostly ignores them. But this one, home repair, countering a warming world. This one sounds so painful that she reads the letter twice. Someone wants to fly her 2,596 miles and back again for a conference about the ruined atmosphere. She can't wrap her head around that title. Home repair. As if we just need to fix the gutters, put in a rooftop swamp cooler, and get back to good times. She sits on her shaker chair at the table, listening to the crickets. Long ago, her father taught her an old formula, one that converts cricket chirps per minute into degrees Fahrenheit. For 60 years, the nighttime orchestra all around her has been playing one of those folk dances that keep speeding up until all the players tumble in a heap. We would be thrilled if you could talk about any role trees might play in helping mankind to a sustainable future. The conference organizers want a keynote from a woman who once wrote a book on the power of woody plants to restore the failing planet. But she wrote that book decades ago, when she was still young enough for courage, and the planet still well enough to rally. These people need dreams of technological breakthrough, some new way to pulp poplar into paper while burning slightly fewer hydrocarbons, some genetically altered cash crop that will build better houses and lift the world's poor from misery. The home repair they want is just a slightly less wasteful demolition. She could tell them about a simple machine needing no fuel and little maintenance, one that steadily sequesters carbon, enriches the soil, cools the ground, scrubs the air, and scales easily to any size. A tech that copies itself and even drops food for free. A device so beautiful, it's the stuff of poems. If forests were patentable, she'd get an ovation. California means 3 days of lost work. Jesus spent less time cleaning out hell. Her agoraphobia has grown over the years, and in those crowded auditoriums she can never hear anyone. But the guest list is incredible. A roll call of wizards and engineers, each of them only one large grant away from dimming the sun with particulates, cloning endangered species, or tapping into unlimited cheap energy. There will be artists and writers to address the messy question of the human spirit, venture capitalists looking for the next green bonanza. She'll never have such an audience again. She rereads the request, picturing a place where sustainable future means something more than dry drunk. She reads through to the letter's stirring closing. As Toynbee once wrote, man achieves civilization as a response to a challenge in a situation of special difficulty, which rouses him to make a hitherto unprecedented effort. The invitation feels like a test of the honesty she has tried to cultivate since her days as a hobo. Someone is asking her what people need to do to save this dying place. Could she possibly tell a gathering of such prominent and powerful people what she thinks is true? Too late tonight for a wise reply. There's still time, though, for a wander down to the rapids of the Middle Prong. Outside her cabin door, dense, slow-growing hawthorns wave spooky prophecies under the near-full moon. Their scarlet fruits cling to the twigs, and many will last the winter. Crategus, the heart healer. People will be discovering medicines there for as long as they go on looking. Her path across the clearing frightens a wallow-rooting possum who wrote off humankind 2 hours ago. She waves the flashlight. The forest floor is piled high with orange and ochre duff, smelling of sweet, moldy cake batter. 2 barred owls, lugubrious and beautiful, call across a great distance. Up the ridge, acorns and hickories hit the ground. Bears everywhere sleep off the day's feast, 2 per square mile. She ducks through drooping rhododendron tunnels, along black cherries that remember old road cuts, past sourwoods and aromatic sassafras. Magnolia and striped maple fill in for the decimated chestnuts. The hemlocks are dying, hit by adelgids and helped along by acid rain. High above, on the Appalachian spine, the Fraser firs are all dead. All around her, the forest reels from the hottest, driest year since the beginning of record-keeping. Yet another freak once-in-a-century event, almost annual these days. Fires are popping up all over the park, code red every third day. But the priestly tulip trees still boost her immune system, while beeches lift her mood and focus her thoughts. Under these giants, she's smarter, clearer. She sees an alligator-barked persimmon. Sweet gum balls, like tiny medieval morning stars, crunch under her feet. She tears just the tip of a fallen gum leaf and sniffs. A child's whiff of heaven. There's a venerable red oak not far from the trail, 12 feet around if it's a foot. It might soothe even the awful restlessness the invitation has inflicted on her. Sustainable future. They don't want a tree woman to keynote their gathering. They want a master illusionist, a sci-fi novelist, the Lorax. Maybe a colorful faith healer with epiphytes for hair. Down in the riverbed, at her favorite scramble, she removes her shoes. But she doesn't need to. A stream that should be raging is just a boulder bed. She turns a few stones in search of salamanders. 30 possible species, countless millions of them in the park, inhabiting every spot of dampness, and she can't find one. She holds her bare feet in the imaginary current. What do you think, then? Go talk, home repair? The memory of a hand rests on her shoulder.
If you have to ask me, babe, you can't afford the answer.
From Streamside on Tennessee's Little River to New York City is a mere 700 miles. Pollen from an eastern white pine could travel it, given a good stiff breeze. At the far end of that route, Adam Appich looks out with puzzled smile across the bowl of 260 first-year psych students listening to his lecture on cognitive blindness to see an armed trio at the back of the auditorium waiting for him to finish. His shock lasts no longer than a few spiked heartbeats. A glance tells him what these men want and why they're here. Of course, the Glock 23s and navy blue raid jackets, stenciled with the yellow letters FBI, help nail down the ID. For decades now, at random moments in every season, from sober noon down into drugged sleep, he has dreaded these men and their arrival. He has waited for them for so long, he forgot they were coming. Now, on this pretty fall day, late in this late year, his captors are here at last, looking much as he always thought they would. Solid, grim, and pragmatic, with wires in their ears. In another smiling blink, Appich's dread gives way to its kissing cousin, the relief of completed predictions. He thinks, they'll come down the aisle and take me at the podium. But the men, five of them, pool in the back, behind the last row of seats, waiting for Adam to wrap up the lecture. Today's topic has been a simple one. When a person makes a choice, so much happens by night, underground, or just out of sight, that the chooser is the last to know. Pages of notes flow over the podium, and Adam's hands brush at nothing. After 2 decades with his shoulders up near his ears, bracing for this hammerfall, his long flinch is over at last. He has worked hard to disappear into achievement. Twice he has won the university's teaching award, and only last month he was nominated for the APA's Beauchamp Prize for research that empirically advances a materialistic understanding of the human mind. He has performed himself in public so long, he's been fooled by his own vita. Now, the choices of his youth come back to blow that fantasy away. Everything comes clear. The chance meeting with the old accomplice, all that tugging on the brim of a ball cap, the extracted confession. We set buildings on fire. We did. They would have given their lives for each other, the five of them. One of them did. A glance down at his handwritten notes. On cue, words boxed in red swim up from the clairvoyant past to the forgetful future. Adam has delivered the line before, for several years running in this survey course, but their full sense has waited for now. He pushes his rimless glasses back up the slope of his sweating nose and shakes his head at the packed hall. What a lesson these students will leave with today. You can't see what you don't understand, but what you think you already understand, you'll fail to notice. A few in the hall chuckle. They can't yet see the men standing behind them at the back of the hall. Some of the students squirrel away the phrase for an exam that will come now in a form altogether different than they expect. Most keep dead still, waiting for education to pass over. Appich flips through his final slides. In 15 seconds, he sums up the attentional studies and delivers his takeaways. He thinks, I haven't been bad at this. Then he dismisses the room, strides up the raked aisle through the sea of students, and shakes the hands of the men who have come to arrest him. He wants to say, what took you so long? his stunned students stare, helpless bystanders, as the agents lead their professor away in cuffs. The agents nudge Appich out of the auditorium onto the sidewalk. The day is beautiful, and the sky the color of a young man's hopes. People cut across their path. The posse must pause for a second for a break in the foot traffic. The whole city is out on an autumn morning, making things happen. A light breeze drives the stink of rancid butter up Adam's nose. He has smelled that medicinal, fruity vomit many times before, but the source of it eludes him now. The navy field jackets lead him a few yards up the sidewalk toward a black Suburban. The men are brusque, but civil, that odd mix of purpose, nerves, and tedium that accompanies the program of enforcement. They rush Adam into the open door. One agent cups his head as they fold him into the rear seat. Adam sits in the secured enclosure, his wrists chained in his lap. In the front seat, an agent talks into a square of black glass, logging the successful capture. The words might as well be birdsong. Someone waves to him through the tinted street-side window. He turns to look. Just alongside the idling vehicle, up through a hole in the concrete, a tree flutters, its leaves like the yellow crayon in a child's eight-pack. Trees have ruined his life. Trees are the reason these men have come to lock him up for whatever years he has left. The van doesn't move. His captors go through the paperwork required for departure. The yellow leaves say, "Look. Now. Here. You won't be outside again for a while." Adam looks and sees just this. A tree he has walked past 3 times a week for 7 years. It's the lone species of the only genus in the sole family in the single order of the solitary class remaining in a now-abandoned division that once covered the earth. A living fossil, 300 million years old, that disappeared from the continent back in the Neogene and has returned to scratch out a living in the shadow, salt, and fumes of Lower Manhattan. A tree older than the conifers, with swimming sperm and cones that can put out 1 trillion and more grains of pollen a year. In ancient island temples on the other side of the earth, 1,000-year-olds, molten and blasted, close to enlightenment, swell to incredible girth, their elbows growing back down from giant branches to re-root into new trunks of their own. Adam could reach out and touch the scrawny trunk, if the windows weren't closed, if his hands weren't cuffed together. A tree like this grew on the street just outside the house of the man who ordered the bombing of Hiroshima, and a small few of them survived that blast. The fruit flesh has a smell that curdles thought. The pulp kills even drug-resistant bacteria. The fan-shaped leaves, with their radiating veins, are said to cure the sickness of forgetting. Adam doesn't need the cure. He remembers. He remembers. Ginkgo, the maidenhair tree. Its leaves leap out sideways into the wind. The Suburban creeps away from the curb and noses into traffic. Adam twists around to look through the rear window. There, as he watches, the whole tree bears. It falls from one moment to the next, the most synchronized drop of leaves that nature ever engineered. A gust of air, some last fluttered objection, and all the veined fans let go at once, releasing a flock of golden telegrams down West 4th Street. How far can a leaf blow? Over the East River, to be sure. Across the shipyard, where a Norwegian immigrant sanded down the massive, curved oak beams of frigate hulls. Through Brooklyn, once hilly and forested, full of chestnuts, upriver, where every 1,000 feet along the waterfront, on every high water mark he can reach, the shipbuilder's descendant has stenciled, "Don't say you weren't." Above the now submerged letters, stands of new buildings compete for something like the sun. Off to the west, across a distance that would take a forest tens of millennia to cross, an old man and woman journey into the world. Over the course of weeks, they've invented a game. Dorothy heads outside and collects twigs, nuts, and shed leaves. Then she brings the evidence back to Ray, and together, with the help of the branching book, they narrow down and name another species. Each time they add a stranger to their list, they stop for days to learn everything they can. There's mulberry, maple, Douglas fir, each one with its unique history, biography, chemistry, economics, and behavioral psychology. Each new tree is its own distinct epic, changing the story of what is possible. Today, though, she comes back inside a little baffled. "There's something wrong, Ray." For Ray, deep into post-mortem life, nothing will ever be wrong again. "What?" he asks her without saying a thing. Her answer is subdued, even mystified. "We must have made a mistake somewhere." They retrace the branches of the decision tree, but end up out on the same limb. She shakes her head, refusing the evidence. "I just don't get it." Now he must croak out loud, a single hard syllable. Something like, "Why?" It takes her a while to answer. Time has become something so very different for them both. "Well, for starters, we're hundreds of miles out of the native range." His body jerks, but she knows the violent spasm is just a shrug. Trees in cities can grow far from anywhere they might call home. The two of them have learned as much from weeks of reading. "Worse than that, there's no range left. There aren't supposed to be more than a handful of mature American chestnut trees left anywhere. This one is almost as tall as the house." They read everything they can about America's perfect vanished tree. They learn about a Holocaust that ravaged the landscape just before they were born. But nothing they discover can explain how a tree that shouldn't exist is spreading a great globe of shade across their backyard. "Maybe there are chestnuts up here that no one knows about." A sound comes out of Ray that Dorothy knows must be a laugh. "Okay, then we have the ID wrong." But there's no other creature in all their growing tree library that it could be. They let the mystery rankle and keep on reading. She finds a book at the public library, The Secret Forest. She brings it home for read aloud. She gets as far as the first paragraph before having to stop. "You and the tree in your backyard come from a common ancestor. 1.5 billion years ago, the two of you parted ways. But even now, after an immense journey in separate directions, that tree and you still share 1/4 of your genes." A page or two may take them a day. Everything they thought their backyard was is wrong. And it takes some time to grow new beliefs to replace the ones that fall. They sit together in silence and survey their acreage as if they have traveled to another planet. Every leaf out there connects underground. Dorothy takes the news like a shocking revelation in a 19th-century novel of manners, where one character's awful secret ripples through every life in the entire village. They sit together in the evening, reading and looking, as the sun glints chartreuse off their chestnuts' scalloped leaves. Every bearing twig seems to Dorothy like a trial creature, apart from but part of all the others. She sees in the chestnut's branching the several speculative paths of a lived life. All the people she might have been, the ones she could or will yet be, in worlds spreading out just alongside this one. She watches the limbs move for a while, then looks back down to the page and reads on out loud. It's sometimes hard to say whether a tree is a single thing or whether it's a million. She starts in on the next startling sentence when a growl from her husband interrupts her. She thinks he's saying, paper cup. Ray? He says the syllables again, and they sound the same. Sorry, Ray, I'm not sure what that means.
Paper cup. Seedling. On the windowsill.
The words come out excited, and they make her skin crawl. His crazed intensity in the falling light makes her think he's having another cerebral accident. Her pulse spikes, and she struggles to her feet. Then she understands. He's entertaining her, turning things as they are into something better, telling her a story in return for the years of stories she has read to him.
Planted it. The chestnut. Our daughter.
Yours? A voice asks. Patricia Westerford clenches. A uniformed man behind the conveyor belt indicates her carry-on as it exits the scanner. She nods, almost nonchalant.
Can we have a look?
It's not really a question, and he doesn't wait for an answer. The bag opens. The hands root through. The pawing is like the bear who works Patricia's blackberry patch at the Smokies' cabin.
What's this?
She slaps her forehead. Senile. My collection kit. He examines the 3/4-inch blade, the pruner that opens to the width of a pencil, the tiny saw shorter than her first pinky joint. The country has been more than a decade without a serious air travel incident, paid for by a billion pocket knives, toothpaste tubes, bottles of shampoo.
What do you collect?
100 wrong answers and not a single right. Plants.
You're a gardener?
Yes. A time and place even for perjury.
And this?
That, she echoes. Stupid, but it buys her 3 seconds. That's just vegetable broth. Her heart pounds so hard it will kill her as cleanly as anything in the jar. The man has power over her, the total power of a panicked nation in pursuit of impossible safety. One glare too blatant, and she'll miss the flight.
This is more than 3 ounces.
She stuffs her shaking hands into her pockets and clamps her jaw. He'll notice. That's his job. He pushes the 2 items back toward her with one hand and her riffled bag with the other.
You can go back into the terminal and mail these.
I'll miss my flight.
Then I'll have to confiscate them.
He drops the plastic jar and collection kit into an already full oil drum.
Have a safe journey.
On the plane, she goes through her keynote one last time. The single best thing a person can do for tomorrow's world. Everything is written out. She hasn't read a speech out loud for years, but she can't trust herself to improvise this one. She comes through the arrival chute at SFO. Drivers stand in a ring at the mouth of the passenger exit, holding up names on pieces of paper. Hers isn't one. An organizer from the conference was supposed to meet her. Patricia waits for several minutes, but no one comes. That's fine with her. Any reason not to go through with this. She sits in a chair against the wall in a corner of the meeting area. A board of glowing letters across the concourse reads, Boston, Boston, Chicago, 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 Dallas, Dallas. Human goings.
human doings, ever faster, ever fuller, ever more mobile, ever more empowered. A motion catches her eye. Even a newborn will turn to look toward a bird in preference to slower, closer things. Her eyes follow the erratic arc. A house sparrow is hopping about on the top of a signboard 15 feet away. It darts on short, purposeful flights around the meeting area. No one in the crowd pays any notice. It skims up into a hidden cranny near the ceiling, then swoops back down again. Soon two, then three, scouting out the trash cans. The first things since boarding that have made her glad. There's something on their legs, like tracking tags, but bigger. She retrieves the roll she stuffed into her purse for dinner, crumbles it onto the chair next to hers. She half expects a security guard to come arrest her. The birds want the prize badly. Each nervous lunge takes them a little nearer for a little longer. At last, gluttony overcomes caution, and one of the sparrows flits in for the steal. Patricia holds still. The sparrow hops closer, feeding. When the angle is right, she reads the ankle bracelet. Illegal alien. She laughs, and the startled bird bolts. A feline woman bears down on her. Dr. Westerford? Patricia smiles and stands. Where have you been? Why haven't you answered your phone? Patricia wants to say, my phone lives in Boulder, Colorado, plugged into the wall. I've been going around and around the arrivals loop. Where's your luggage? The entire project of home repair seems to be teetering. This is my luggage. The girl is dumbstruck. But you'll be here for 3 days. These birds, Patricia begins. Yeah, somebody's joke. The airport can't figure out how to get rid of them. Why would you want to? The driver isn't built for philosophy. We're over this way. They crawl out of the city and down the central peninsula. The driver names the luminaries who will speak over the next few days. Patricia watches the scenery. On their right, the hills of second-growth redwood. On their left, Silicon Valley, the future's factory. The driver loads Dr. Westerford with plastic folders and drops her at the faculty club. Patricia has all afternoon to wander the most extraordinary collection of campus trees in the country. She finds a marvelous blue oak, regal California planes, incense cedars, a gnarled anarchical pepper tree, dozens of the 700 species of eucalypts, kumquats in full fruit. Every student must be drunk on the air's intoxicants without even knowing. It's a Christmas of lignin, old lost friends, trees she has never seen, pines spinning out cones in perfect Fibonacci swirls, backwater genera, Matinus, Syzygium, Sisyphus. She combs them and all the bedding plants beneath for extracts to replace the ones the TSA confiscated. A walkway takes her alongside the apse of a fake Romanesque church. She passes under a monumental three-trunked avocado, way too close to the wall, that probably began life on a secretary's desk. Popping through a portal into a courtyard, she stops and touches a hand to her lips. Trees. Mighty, improbable, outlandish trees that have come from some golden age pulp novel about the teeming jungles beneath the acid clouds of Venus stand whispering to each other.